no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
And I'm Michael Isikoff.
And this is Spy Talk. Well, Mike, it's nice not to start with Tulsi Gabbard.
I think she's been the lead for our Spy Talk podcast for about the last 2 months because she is such great copy, as we used to say in the newspaper game.
So to clean the palate, so to speak, I'll mention some late breaking news. The New York Times is reporting that the Chinese are using AI to pump up their disinformation campaigns. And this is seen as a grave threat in the malign influence sphere, like the Russians applied so efficiently during the 2016 campaign and onward. So I'm going to be writing more about that later this week. Meanwhile, the news we have about Tulsi and company is really political news, which is that Pam Bondi has formed a strike force.
Well, not only that, but she's also reportedly convened a federal grand jury.
And a grand
jury. Which is a serious step towards a, potential criminal charges here against Obama-era officials, and presumably including even Obama himself, for supposedly manufacturing or concocting what the MAGA people like to call the Russia hoax.
Well, it's yet to be seen how 24 members of the grand jury, true and upstanding citizens, how they will view this evidence.
Yeah, it's hard to see what the charges are here. First of all,
treason.
We're way outside the statute of limitations for one. So you have to somehow show some kind of ongoing conspiracy by these Obama officials, and I don't see how you get from there to actual evidence of criminal acts committed against the United States.
When previous Republican-led investigations have said there's no there. So
I'm wondering if this is going to end up as another Epstein matter with egg on their collective faces, promising a whole lot to their MAGA base. Hey, criminal charges coming. We're going to expose the Russia hoax. But when it gets down to actually bringing charges and trying to find evidence of a crime, it's hard to see how they get it. So, you know, will we have another MAGA flare up over a promise from Bondi that is not
delivered? Well, in my humble opinion,
yes,
I don't think they care if they get charges to stick or not. This is kind of a weak distraction effort to keep people's eyes averted from Epstein. They're throwing all the chaff they can into the wind to see what sticks. And so it's performative. And so that's not so much of the spy world for us now. That's politics, partisanship, infecting the spy world.
Well, and the weaponization of law enforcement, which is something within our purview here, our jurisdiction at the Spy Talk.
But in a refreshing vacation from that this week. Yeah. We're going to go back into Cold War history
with a spy story.
We love spy stories. That's what we do here.
Yeah.
And Mike, tell us a little bit about your guest today.
The one we're going to talk about today with Dan Efron, the executive editor of Foreign Policy, is the story of really one of the most extraordinary spy swaps in history, in world history, I would venture, and that was the Cuba-U.S. spy swap in 2014, when the United States let out of prison Gerardo Hernandez, the ringleader of a group called the Cuban Five, five Cuban spies who infiltrated South Florida in the 1990s to spy not so much on the U.S. government, but on anti-Castro groups that the Cubans, with some justification, feared were plotting terrorist acts against them. And of course, there is a long history of anti-Castro terrorism. I would say,
if you go all the way back, deep into the Cold War, and Kennedy administration plots to kill him, I would say that Fidel Castro and the subsequent regimes have had substantial reasons to infiltrate any Castro group.
Right. And, you know, 1976, the shootdown of a Cubana Airlines flight that killed the entire Cuban fencing team. 73 people died. Anti-Castro groups were responsible for that. There were bombings throughout Havana in the 1990s. So anyway.
And here.
So you have the Cuban Five were spies, Cuban spies, set up to penetrate those groups, spy on them, and let their handlers in Havana know about what might be in the offing. And at the same time, the Cubans in 2011 locked up an American contractor, Alan Gross, who was an AID contractor who had come to Havana to come to Cuba.
The now defunct USAID.
Yeah, the now defunct. Anyway, all that led to quite a bit of there was high level negotiations for Hernandez. The leader of the Cuban Five was locked up in a federal prison in California with a double life sentence with no possibility of parole. I have a small role, cameo role in the story. I went and interviewed him in prison in while he was there, because the Cubans were demanding his release as a price for releasing Alan Gross. I thought there was no chance he would ever get out. No, you know, when you have a double life sentence convicted by a jury in Miami, upheld by an appellate court. But there were people who saw this as an opening to restore and revive U.S.-Cuba relations and the Cold War. Ben Rhodes, who was Obama's speechwriter, was the envoy in all these super secret negotiations. Dan Efron has reconstructed the story, and it's a really engrossing 8-part podcast series. We're going to be talking to him about it in a moment. And, you know, I'm of two minds about this. On the one hand, it does show the potential for creative diplomacy when you have a White House that is committed to breaking free from the shackles of the past, as Obama put it at one point. But on the same token, it's really a depressing period piece, because there was a moment there in 2014, 2015, 2016, when it looked like we were on the eve of a new dawn in U.S.-Cuba relations. People-to-people exchanges, U.S. tourists could come back, American investment. And then it all went south. Trump came in, committed to reversing every one of Obama's policies. The Havana Syndrome, you know, gave Trump an excuse to empty out the U.S. embassy in Havana.
Even though that was occurring elsewhere in the world.
Yeah. And at the same time, the Cubans didn't help things much by sort of, you know, locking up political protesters by the hundreds, reminding people that they were still essentially a police state.
Okay, well, let's not give it all away here. So we have a spy story with a strong element of diplomatic intrigue. And I, for one, am looking forward to hearing it. So take it away.
We are now joined by my old Newsweek colleague, Dan Efron, now executive editor of Foreign Policy, who has produced and narrates the new podcast documentary, I Spy, the U.S., Cuba, and the Secret Deal that Ended the Cold War. Dan, welcome to Spy Talk.
Thanks, Mike.
And congrats on the pod. It's really an engrossing story, extraordinary one in so many ways, but also, we'll talk about this, a kind of depressing one, given where things are today. Tell us, just to start out, what drew you to the story? What prompted you to want to make a eight-part podcast series about the 2014 U.S.-Cuba spy swap?
Yeah, sure. And thanks for saying that, Mike. You are much more an authority on Cuba than I am. And in fact, at some point I came to you and said, hey, I know nothing about Cuba. I am delving into this thing. I am trying to get the Cubans to play ball here and be cooperative. And you were basically like, good luck.
I tried a little to help, but
try to help, and you gave me some contacts. I met Alan Gross. So Alan Gross is the protagonist, or one of the protagonists in the story itself. And he was held in Cuba for 5 years. He held in a Cuban prison there for 5 years. He went down there as a private contractor. He was subcontracted by an American company. He got in trouble, and was caught and sentenced to prison there. And he spent 5 years there and came out, and as part of a prisoner swap. That's the subject of the story of the podcast. After he got out, and I have to say, I did not follow this very closely. This was 2009 to 2014. But after he came out, I read someplace that he had moved to Israel, or at least he bought an apartment in Israel and spent some of his time there. Now, I was reporting in Israel a lot at the time, and on one of my trips there, I found his number and called him up and said, hey, you know, I'm a journalist and I'm interested in your story. Would you be interested in having coffee? And I think that first meeting was off the record. And he told me roughly, you know, what we know about his time in Cuba, his time in prison, and so on. But I will say that the story, the anecdote at that coffee that stuck with me was the anecdote about sperm diplomacy. And I think that, you know, I left the cafe thinking, okay. Well, right. He had me at sperm diplomacy, and this is worth revisiting.
Absolutely. We've all heard about ping pong diplomacy between the U.S. and China. Sperm diplomacy was the key to the U.S.-Cuba spy swap. But, you know, the Gross story, I did cover it some at the time. I was at NBC then, and it was a bit of a cause celeb. I mean, his plight was a really gut-wrenching one. You know, a do-gooder American contractor who goes to Cuba to spread, you know, the internet to a tiny Jewish community, and he's locked up on suspicions of espionage, accused of being subverting the country's government. You know, you actually, you know, dug into the circumstances of how he came to be there in the first place. And I think that's noteworthy. This is the latter days of the Bush administration. Regime change was very much still in its DNA. And the actual AID contract was not quite as innocent as folks originally thought it was. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I'll start by saying that USAID has done, and, you know, RIP, rest in peace, because we're at this moment where the Trump administration has more or less killed off, I wouldn't even say more or less, has killed off USAID. And that's a shame, because this is a government agency that has done for decades. It did good work around the world in terms of delivering humanitarian aid and helping after natural disasters and doing a bunch of other stuff. But USAID's policy on Cuba was always a little dodgy. In other words, it wasn't so much the model of connect with the host government and try to deliver aid. It was more like work against the host government. And this was in line with American policy on Cuba for decades, since 1959, since Fidel Castro's revolution in Cuba. Try to work against the host government, undermine the host government, often do it in a way that was secretive. You know, USAID was never a spy agency. Alan Gross was not a spy, but he contracted or subcontracted with USAID to go to Cuba to deliver internet hubs around the island, to set them up in a way that was against Cuban law and was designed really to undermine the Cuban restrictions on internet, the Cuban censorship.
I mean, you quote from the contract there at times saying it's about, you know, hastening the day for the transition to a democratic society and breaking the information blockade by the Cuban government, restricting internet access to its people. You know, worthy goals on their face, right? I mean, yeah, we'd all love to see a democratic Cuba in which people have access to the same, you know, writings around the world that everybody else does. But it was clearly something that the Cuban government was not going to look kindly on.
Cuban government was not going to look kindly on it. But also there was a context here of decades of trying to overthrow the regime, the Cuban regime, the Castro regime, in all kinds of unsavory ways, including assassination, including coup attempts.
Right.
And then there was the more recent context of, the war on terror, the war in Iraq, the, you know, trying to spread democracy in this way that was certainly by 2009, when Alan Gross makes his first trip to Cuba, had failed as an American policy.
Right. Did you ever get any insight into how that contract came to be written? Were there political people in the Bush administration who were pushing it as part of a regime change policy?
I don't know much about that, in part because USAID wouldn't be interviewed. In other words, we had a couple of conversations by phone where I said, look, here are all the things that I'm reporting out. Can you come in? Sit down for an interview and let's just hash through this. They were very polite, but they didn't want to talk about it. But I think at least since the 90s, since the Helms-Burton Act, you know, U.S. administrations have been involved in crafting policy for USAID when it comes to the issue of Cuba and kind of using USAID as an instrument of American policy towards Cuba.
So there is Alan Gross sitting in a prison in Cuba for years, losing weight, becoming suicidal. American members of Congress are flying down to Havana trying to call attention to his plight. Obama officials are trying to explore ways to get him free. And the Cubans say, okay, you want to talk Gross? Let's talk about the Cuban Five.
Yeah, so the Cuban Five were these intelligence agents, Cuban intelligence agents who had engaged in this intelligence operation in the 1990s in Miami, in the United States, in Florida, and, you know, were sent here undercover. They were effectively spies. They were spying on groups in Miami that are anti-Castro groups, tend to operate against Cuba, had done all kinds of things to undermine the Cuban regime. The Cubans are very worried about these groups. And this group of spies infiltrates these anti-Castro groups. It isn't so much spies who are trying to spy on U.S. institutions, you know, the State Department or the CIA. That's not the story. It's Cuban intelligence agents coming here to infiltrate these anti-Castro groups. They do that pretty effectively. And eventually they're caught. And they're arrested and they're sentenced to long prison terms. The protagonist in the story that I tell is Gerardo Hernandez. He gets two life sentences for engaging in this espionage in the 90s. And the Cubans are desperate to get these guys back. These guys become national heroes in Cuba. And I don't need to tell you, you visited both Cuba and then, of course, Gerardo Hernandez in prison in that period, long before this was on my radar, you know, around the island in Cuba, billboards with the faces of the Cuban Five, postage stamps with their faces. These guys are real heroes. And as soon as right. Cuba arrests Alan Gross, they think, well, we've got a bargaining chip. We've got a way to try right. to trade him for our boys, get them back.
I did meet Gerardo Hernandez first in prison, later when he was free in Havana. He's a really interesting guy, very engaging, very chatty, big laugh. But he's he was an intelligence officer, no question about it. I remember in my first interview with him in prison, I asked him any regrets. He said, "I regret that I got caught." We should add, the reason he had a double life sentence is one of the charges for which he was convicted was conspiracy to commit murder. It was conspiracy to commit espionage and conspiracy to commit murder. And the murder charge was about the 1996 shoot down of the Brothers to the Rescue flights over Cuba. Tell us what happened there and how Hernandez got roped into that.
Yeah.
Scheme.
And I have to say that, you know, I looked through all these legal documents, the case itself. I don't know that I'm entirely convinced that that was a proper conviction. But the story is that Brothers to the Rescue is a group in Miami, anti-Castro group. It's one of the groups that the Cubans, Hernandez, and the rest of the intelligence agents infiltrate. And they're trying to undermine Cuba. They're trying to undermine the regime. One of the things that they do is send these Cessnas, these small planes, to fly over Cuba and drop leaflets or pick up rafters, Cubans who are trying to flee the island, pick them up and bring them to Miami. This is mainly the flyovers and the other stuff that they do is a source of great aggravation for the Castros, for the regime in Cuba. And at some point, I think the Cubans signal to the United States that if these guys keep violating Cuban airspace, they're going to shoot them down. They're going to shoot down these Cessnas that are flown by Brothers to the Rescue.
They were dropping leaflets, right? I mean, it's not like they were dropping weapons.
Correct. Yeah, dropping leaflets that tried to, you know, get the population to rise up. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, from the Cuban perspective, they sort of turn a blind eye once, twice, three times. At some point, these Cessnas cross into Cuban airspace. And the Cubans scramble, I think, their MiGs, basically their Soviet warplanes, and shoot them down and kill, is it three people, Mike? I believe
four.
It's four people.
Four.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Hernandez is not, you know, Gerardo Hernandez is not involved in, you know, obviously he's in Miami. He's not involved in scrambling the jets or shooting down the planes, but the case is made in court years later in Miami that he knew about because, you know, they had penetrated this group, Brothers to the Rescue. He knew about the flight plans. He knew when they would be crossing into Cuban airspace. He informed his bosses about the timing of that, and that allowed for the shoot down and the killing of these four young men.
Right. And you make the point, this was a jury in Miami where jurors are not likely to be sympathetic to Cuban intelligence officers. And Hernandez, at least one federal appellate judge did dispute the evidence against Hernandez on the murder charge. But it was a 2-1 for the Court of Appeals in Atlanta, upheld the conviction. So there's Hernandez with this, you know, seemingly hopeless life sentence. But I went and interviewed him in 2012 in prison. The Cubans were saying, "Hey, you want Gross back? You know, we want Hernandez back." I thought the case was hopeless. I didn't see any way that you could get around a federal conviction that had been upheld on appeal. But I did include some audio clips from my interview with Hernandez in an NBC News, Nightly News and Today Show pieces in 2012. I was down in Havana. But the interview that really made the difference was I was given an interview with Adriana Hernandez's wife, and she choked up, got very teary, and talked about how much she missed her husband and how much she wanted to have his baby. She was 43 years old. The biological clock was ticking fast. And this seemed to be our number one priority for her and the Cubans.
Yeah. Adriana is a story in you know, her own right. Also a very interesting woman, full of, you know, these are larger than life characters. You sort of hope to get, when you tell a story like this, characters like Gerardo, like Alan Gross, and like Adriana, who by then, if my math is correct, by the time you went and interviewed her in Cuba, had not seen her husband in 14 years,
I believe. Yeah.
And was, in her 40s and wanted and desperately missed him. It sounds like this was a big love, a real loving relationship, and desperately wants to get pregnant. And is pushing the Americans, I mean, certainly journalists, but anyone that she meets, including American diplomats who come to Cuba from time to time, trying to inquire about this, you know, the condition of Alan Gross, and inquire about whether there's a way to do some diplomacy, some swap. She says to them, look, my issue is my husband, who's been in a prison for a long time, along with his colleagues, the other intelligence agents, and specifically the urgency to have a child, to have a baby. And that story resonates in particular with one guy, Tim Reeser, who's a Senate staffer who works for Patrick Leahy, and he deals with foreign policy issues. And he goes to Cuba with Leahy, and they meet with Adriana, much the way you met with Adriana.
Yeah, this was actually just a month or two after my interview with her, where she had been on national television on NBC talking about how much she wanted to have a baby. Yes.
And this pitch really resonates with Leahy and Leahy's wife, who is there, and with Tim Reeser, this staffer, this aide to Leahy. And they go back to the United States and set about trying to make it happen, trying to create some kind of confidence building measure. This isn't a swap. This isn't the deal itself. But what can the United States do for Adriana and Gerardo in this endeavor for her to have a child that would create enough goodwill that maybe Alan Gross would benefit, maybe his conditions would be improved, or maybe there would be kind of a breakthrough that would allow some prisoner swap. And I imagine that you met with Tim Reeser over the years. He sort of says, you know, we flew back from Cuba to the United States, and I knew that my boss was going to put this on me. Of course, I was going to have to do this. And how do you arrange something like this with the prison service, which, you know, was very difficult to do? And really, how do you begin? Who do you call? What is that first phone call you make to try to make it happen?
Bureau of Prisons.
Right. Bureau of Prisons, although I think it went through at some point the Attorney General himself.
Well, Leahy goes directly to Eric Holder, then the Attorney General. Exactly. Bureau of Prisons officials don't know what to make of Reeser's request. And by the way, one of the most interesting things in your podcast is the State Department was almost apoplectic about this idea when they learned about it. Roberta Jacobson, who was the Assistant Secretary for Western Hemisphere Affairs, she's worried, my God, what if the Florida delegation learns out we're trying to accommodate the wishes of the family of a convicted Cuban spy?
Yeah, this is one of those realizations, you know, as a person who I spent almost, you know, much of my career reporting about the Middle East, about Israelis and Palestinians. Yeah. I have to say, by the way, there are some similarities in that between, you know, in the conflict.
You can see a lot of his similarities. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Not as bloody as the one in the Mideast, but certainly the hostilities are
deep.
Yes,
exactly. And, and just how long lasting they are and just how much oxygen they take up in Washington for essentially the comings and goings of a relatively small conflict, a relatively small country. So one of the things, you know, I came to understand is just how concerned American politicians and diplomats and, you know, public servants, foreign service people are about saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing in regards to Cuban policy, and then getting the anti-Castro lobby to turn on them and be against them. And this includes, you know, Roberta Jacobson, very senior State Department official, who just felt like, why would we do this? This guy has been convicted of conspiracy to commit murder. He's in a prison as a Cuban intelligence operative. You know, what do we get in return was one question, but also what is the blowback going to be in terms of domestic politics?
But notwithstanding her objections, Holder has signed off. And one day in the federal prison in Victorville, California, very remote place, by the way, like an hour and a half outside of L.A., in the middle of nowhere, Hernandez gets told to come to the health clinic. It's been emptied out. He's given a plastic cup and told to deposit his sperm.
Yeah. And, you know, he was sort of in the picture here. He didn't know all the details. He knew about his wife, you know, lobbying for this, agitating for this. They would talk on the phone. Sometimes she would hint at things. They would talk in code. He certainly had an idea that this was what, you know, what was going to happen. But he knew that it had taken years and a colossal diplomatic effort. And so when he hands over the cup to the doctor in the prison, he sort of says to him, you know, take good care of this. And how is this going to get, you know, from where you are to where my wife needs to be? They eventually transport it to Panama. And
how did it get there? I know that was something you were very focused on. How did the sperm get from that the prison in Victorville to a fertility clinic in Panama where Adriana had frozen her eggs?
Yeah, I have to say that this is a little detail that I obsessed over. And it's not really important in terms of the broader scheme of things. It doesn't matter. It got there and she got pregnant. But journalistically, and I think you'll certainly understand this, you're envisioning the story. And, you know, I was imagining some State Department official who in his carry-on has a vial of sperm from a Cuban intelligence agent that he has to deliver to a clinic in Panama. And who is that State Department official or FBI officer? And can we talk to him? And so I spent a lot of time chasing this down, and a lot of people told me they don't know. And I suspect that some of the people who told me they don't know did know. But because of all the issues we discussed, because of the lobby, because of the pressure, didn't want to talk about it. And eventually, Hernandez himself told me that it was a very easy explanation. The doctor from the clinic in Panama, from the fertility clinic, flew to the United States, to Victorville, picked up the sperm sample, and took it back with him.
I'm just wondering, when you're going through customs, whether anything you're bringing back into the country or taking from the country. Anyway, the bottom line is, by 2014, Adriana is pregnant. The world doesn't know about this, but the objective of this operation has succeeded. We're going to take a quick break here, and then when we come back, we're going to talk to Dan about what else was going on that put all these strands together that eventually led to that spy swap. And we are back with Dan Efron, executive editor of Foreign Policy and narrator of I Spy, the U.S., Cuba, and the Secret Deal That Ended the Cold War, a new podcast on Audible. Dan, we've talked about the sperm diplomacy that got Adriana, wife of intelligence officer Gerardo Hernandez, pregnant, but there's a lot of more going on behind the scenes. What was happening?
Yeah, so as that part of the diplomacy is underway, and it's really just a strand, it's just one small part of the story, the Obama administration is thinking, what do we do about Cuba? This is a country that has been, you know, effectively in a state of hostility with the United States since 1959 for decades. But time has passed. the Cold War ended decades earlier. And Obama is asking his aides, why are we still engaging in this policy of hostility with the Cubans, of sanctions against the Cubans, an issue that really damages the Cuban economy, but also drives out a bunch of immigrants from Cuba, and they come to American shores. And immigration, of course, is always an issue here in the United States. And he waits until the start of his second term. And in January 2013, he convenes his people and he has a conversation and says, you know, what do we do about this? There's the matter of Alan Gross. We want to get him back, but there are the bigger issues. And at one of these meetings, he sort of says, who wants to take this on? Who wants to take lead on this? And Ben Rhodes, who is one of Obama's speechwriters, he's at the National Security Council working for Obama, raises his hand and says, I'll do this. I would like to do this. Rhodes had no experience with Cuba, no diplomatic experience. I think he was about 35 at the time. And he says, by the way, that in retrospect, it was a little cheeky of him to raise his hand, but really wanted to do other things, bigger things than what he had done up until that point.
Yeah. You know, Ben Rhodes, there's a lot of Ben Rhodes in your series. I've interviewed him as well. And, you know, listening to it, he struck me as a guy straight out of the West Wing. You know, world weary, wise to the ways of Washington exterior, but underneath, you know, a do-gooder idealist wants to make a better world. And, you know, and I think everything flows from that. If you just look at him as an Aaron Sorkin West Wing character, you know, Ben Rhodes fits it to the T. So they begin. Secret, how do these secret negotiations begin, and where, and who is Ben Rhodes talking to?
Yeah. So the Americans signal to the Cubans that they want to sit down and have a negotiation. Of course, it has to be secret. It's secretive because of the sensitivity of the relationship, the hostility over all these years, and the American political issue, the American lobby that hates the idea of any kind of rapprochement with Cuba. The Cubans are on board. They want to engage in this conversation. Of course, the Cubans have a lot of complaints about American policy over the decades, including the siege on Cuba, the sanctions against Cuba, which they want lifted. They want their intelligence agents back. So they're ready to engage. And they choose someone who's very close to power in Cuba, Alejandro Castro. He is the son of Raul Castro, who was the president of Cuba at the time, mm-hmm. and they're ready to send him to the negotiations. And now, you know, Ben Rhodes has to figure out, where are we going to do this? It has to be secret. Ben Rhodes is kind of a familiar figure in kind of the American public. So you don't want to do it anywhere public. You probably don't want to do it anywhere in the United States. And he sort of thinks, well, where do you go to conduct secret diplomacy? Of course, you go to Canada, and the Canadians are ready to host them and have this kind of well-oiled mechanism for hosting peacemakers in the countryside, in this beautiful home. And, you know, Rhodes sort of describes flying to Canada, getting around customs. They get him in without stamping his passport, all part of the secrecy of it, being driven to this beautiful, luxurious home and waiting for Alejandro Castro, his counterpart, to walk in and meeting him for the first time.
And when was this? About when was this in the timeline?
This was in around June 2013.
This is while the Alan Gross stuff is all going on, and it's before 2013?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, so it's shortly after Leahy and Reeser have met with Adriana and begun the sperm diplomacy on their own. That was not something, well, it did get signed off on by Holder, so the Obama administration had to know what was happening.
Yeah, yeah, these two things are happening separately.
Right.
Some people, you know, Ben Rhodes is aware of Leahy and what they're doing and trying to help Adriana get pregnant. Leahy and his staffer, Tim Reeser, are not really aware until later of this negotiation that's being conducted. And in fact, the negotiation itself is very closely held. Very small number of people in Washington know about it. At the State Department, almost no one knows about it. State Department is, you know, it's the U.S. agency that engages in American foreign policy and American diplomacy, and yet they are mostly in the dark. This is a White House operation and a National Security Council.
John Kerry is the Secretary of State at this point. Does he know what's going on?
Not until much later.
Really? That's pretty extraordinary on its face. The State Department cut out of secret negotiations with a foreign adversary.
Because they're afraid that if this gets out, that the anti-Castro lobby will mobilize and will bring pressure to bear and will scuttle the negotiations and it won't go anywhere. And Obama has two things in mind. You know, when he looks at the history of contacts with the Cubans, negotiations with the Cubans, one is you have to do it secretly. And the other is you have to put everything on the table. If you do it incrementally, you start and then word comes out and then people mobilize against it and then it's scuttled.
Mm. So Rhodes and a sidekick. Who's the sidekick?
Ricardo Zuniga.
And who is he?
Ricardo Zuniga is a National Security Council official who has a lot of experience with Cuba on Cuban issues.
So he's White House. He's not State Department. He's not right. In any way. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
So
right.
They're meeting yes. with Alessandro Castro, and you've got this really interesting exchange from Rhodes in which Castro goes on a tirade about all the horrible things the United States government has done to Cuba over the years, trying to assassinate Castro, trying to overthrow its government, invading the country, you know, sending in spies and saboteurs. And Rhodes tries to deflect, respond. It's an interesting moment to tell us what happened.
Yeah, you know, Rhodes is a beautiful storyteller. Rhodes has a you know, his education, his scholarship. He has a master's of fine arts in creative writing.
By the way, when I said before he's a character out of the West Wing, I meant the TV show.
Yes, of course. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And I think, by the way, I mean, you're talking about that idealism. I think if you ask him today, what are the things he's most proud of from his years in Washington, he'll say Cuba, because, you know, he helped bring these two countries together. And I think if you ask him about his biggest disappointments, the most crushing disappointments, it is Cuba. It is the fact that deal didn't hold up, which we'll, I suppose we'll talk about. But So they're in this beautiful house in Canada, and the Cubans, the Castros specifically just seem to have the ability to stand up and speechify for long periods of time. Fidel Castro was famous for this. And
it's a family heritage.
Yes. And so is his nephew, Alejandro Castro, there in the house. And he gets up and there's just a litany of complaints about the Americans and the crimes of the Americans against Cuba over the years. And, you know, it's one of these moments, as Ben Rhodes tells it, where he's trying to set the table here and start something new. And he is thinking, as Castro is winding on and on about this, what do I say? And when Castro finally finishes, he just looks at him and says, you know, I'm sure some of that is true. I would probably dispute some of it, but that's not why I'm here. And I will say, I was not even alive when most of this happened. And Obama, the man who sent me here, the president of the United States, was not alive during a lot of the events that you're recounting. It's important to remember these things, but we're here to try to move past them. And that kind of sets the atmosphere for the talks and is really the first breakthrough, at least in terms of the two sides coming together and understanding what they're trying to do and how they're trying to push forward.
Let's listen to a clip of Rhodes describing this moment in the podcast.
And I was sitting there and I was thinking, okay, what do I have that I can use here. I'm close to Obama and I'm young, and you know, I'll be honest, like my youth, you know, I was self-conscious of this. I'm like in my 30s, I'm in this high stakes negotiation. But at that point I realized, well, let me turn this to my advantage in a way. So when he was done, I said, look, and I made a point of kind of pushing my talking points away from in front of me. Like I understand that history is like really important to you. And I respect that history is really important to you. I'm sure that I could like take issue with some of it, and some of it's true, right? Which I think probably US officials don't normally say. And I was like, but I wasn't even born when some of this stuff happened. And he laughed at that, you know? And I was like, you know, and I'm here because like I work for Barack Obama, and he wasn't even born when some of this stuff happened. And he certainly wants to get past it. That's why I'm here.
So that does, you know, move things seemingly forward for a while, but there are hitches. And at some point, the Vatican and the Pope get involved, which is pretty unusual on its face.
Yeah, I mean, there are any number of hitches, and part of this is just what happens in diplomacy between two countries that are at odds over decades. And part of it is, you know, the actual nitty-gritty of the negotiation. There are three by now Cuban intelligence officials, others have been released, three Cuban intelligence people in American prisons that the Cubans want back. And the Americans are saying, well, three for one, you know, we have to get more in exchange for just these three. How do we deal with that? All these things are being negotiated, but they come to a framework agreement, essentially, where they iron out all of these issues, almost all of these issues. And then I think it's Zuniga, who is the second American negotiator, who goes to Canada, and it's really just the two of them. It's just Ben Rhodes and Ricardo Zuniga. He says, you know, we need someone to guarantee the agreement. You know, the Cubans might be willing to lie to us, but they're not going to lie to the Pope, and vice versa. The Americans might be willing to tell, you know, tall stories in the negotiating room, but if you're standing at the Vatican in front of the Pope, you know, there's a kind of impact here where he keeps you honest.
So Zuniga out of nowhere is bringing up the Pope. Maybe we can get the Pope to guarantee this deal. I mean,
yeah, look, I think the idea that I think the things that they were thinking about were the following. There's a lot of mistrust between the two sides. Let's get some third party involved, but also let's try to get a third party involved who can potentially bring the Cuban lobby, the anti-Castro lobby in Washington on board, so that if this third party person puts his imprimatur on the deal, then Miami will be on board. The Cubans of Miami, the Cubans of New Jersey, the Cuban American community here, which has been, you know, hostile to the Castro regime all these decades, that they would be at least inclined to give it a chance. And this is how the idea of the Pope comes up. A lot of respect for the Pope, a lot of Catholics among the Cuban community. And as it happens, as they're talking about this, as they're thinking about this, Obama already has a meeting with Pope Francis on his calendar at the Vatican. They go to Rome. Ben Rhodes is there because he travels with the president, because he writes his speeches often. And he's prepping Obama, you know, you're going to raise this thing with the Pope, right? You know, there are a bunch of issues, obviously, that the U.S. president discusses with the Pope, not just an agreement with Cuba, but for Rhodes, you know, let's talk about that. And what are you going to say? And how are you going to make sure that he's on board?
And the Pope agrees. And so what happens? I mean, do the negotiations continue in the Vatican?
Yeah, the Pope agrees, which is a big deal, certainly for the United States and later for the Cubans. They come back, they make a last push, they get the deal in place, they go back to the Vatican to read out the agreement. They sit down with the Pope's Secretary of State or the Vatican's Secretary of State and read out the agreement point by point. The Americans and the Cubans sitting in the room with this Vatican official. That's the moment Ben Rhodes says to himself, okay, now it's real. Yeah. Now we've been to Rome. We've talked to the Pope. We've gone through this whole thing. It's still a secret. there are still maybe a few dozen people in Washington who know about the negotiation. But now that the deal is real and there's going to be a timetable for it to be announced, and there's a whole ceremony around the announcement, you know, Obama makes an announcement and then Castro.
But before we get to that, though, we should add that there's another player in this spy swap who's included, who was not known, not part of the PR campaigns on either side, a CIA mole inside the Cuban intelligence directorate by the name of spy by the name of Trujillo, who had been arrested by the Cubans. And he was a pretty significant spy for the CIA.
Yeah, exactly. When we talked about that imbalance, the Cubans wanted three people back. The Americans were going to get one person back. And, and you know, Ben Rhodes kept saying, we can't do this 3-to-1 thing. At some point, the CIA says to Ben Rhodes, you're talking to the Cubans. Here's what we want. We want this guy released. We want the Cubans who are holding this Cuban intelligence guy, fairly senior intelligence official, who had spied on our behalf, had given the CIA secrets, and been caught and sentenced to a long prison term in Cuba. We want you to get the Cubans to release him as well. And that was a tough sell with the Cubans, in part because he was the guy who knew the codes that Gerardo Hernandez and the other spies in Miami were using to send encoded messages back to Havana. And he gave the Americans those codes.
He fingered the Cuban Five to the Americans.
Exactly.
I mean, he's the reason they were in prison.
Exactly. So here's the bitter pill, right? You know, the Americans tell the Cubans, if you want your heroes back, you've got to give up the guy who fingered them, who basically caused them to get arrested. And it's a tough decision on the Cuban side, but they eventually agree for this swap. And yeah, Trujillo is included in this spy deal, in this spy swap.
So cut to December 2014, and Barack Obama in Washington and Raul Castro in Havana simultaneously announce that the U.S. and Cuba will restore diplomatic relations after more than a half a century of Cold War hostilities. It is a dramatic milestone moment in American diplomacy. They also announce the spy swap, and Gerardo Hernandez is let out of federal prison with his double life sentence and flies home to his to see his wife, who's now given birth to their little baby daughter. And Alan Gross is set free to return home to his home in Bethesda. It seems like a joyous moment. I should add, just my own personal role, when Hernandez got back, a lot of people wanted to interview him about his plight. He said, I want to give my first interview to the guy who came to see me in prison. And I got invited to meet with Gerardo, Adriana, their baby, in their safe house in Havana. Hernandez was in a great mood. I asked him to compare his life in Cuba, in freedom, with in freedom for him anyway, to his life in prison. He said, I have a new warden now, my mother-in-law. She was hovering in the background with the baby. And then that night, I strolled with him and his Cuban Five colleagues through the streets of Havana. They were mobbed, surrounded. Everybody wanted their picture taken with them, their autographs. It was a truly a joyous moment, at least for them. And I think that there was a lot of hope that this would be a new dawn in U.S.-Cuba relations, but it was not to be.
Yeah, let me just say two quick things about this. One is, there is a lesson here for journalists, and this is something I admire about you, Michael. You went to see Gerardo Hernandez in prison when no one else was chasing down this story. And, you know, it was off the radar. And that then pays off for you 3 years later when he's released, because he remembers this is a guy who was interested in me, who made the trip. Right. And I
totally unexpected, I should say. Yeah.
The other thing I want to say, one other thing I want to point out is that this secret remained a secret until the release itself, until the announcement itself. Right. I think it leaked on CNN maybe an hour or two before before the release. And, you know, the Americans were very grateful that it didn't leak. The Cubans were very grateful, but they still had this issue of the pregnancy of Adriana. They had hidden Adriana from public view as she was getting larger and larger, as her pregnancy was showing, because they didn't want the story of the diplomacy to come out. They also didn't want Cubans to suspect that maybe she was cheating on her husband, this national hero, and had become pregnant by another man. And when Gerardo lands in Havana and is greeted by his wife, and this is televised, she is in her ninth month.
She had not yet delivered.
Right.
Because when I was down in February of 15, and the baby had just been born.
Yes. So she's born, I think, 2 weeks after.
2 weeks after his return.
So imagine he goes from being in prison for 15 years to being home, seeing his wife for the first time in years, seeing that she's pregnant, and then 2 weeks later becoming a father.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But we're pivoting to the aftermath.
Right.
And how it all unraveled.
Right.
And I just got to say, because it did. And, you know, as you point out in the last episode of your series, you know, Cuba today is a basket case.
Yeah.
You know, power shortages, you know, blackouts. Over 1 million people have left the island. That's staggering. 9% of the population has abandoned Cuba. The U.S. embargo remains in place. The whatever Obama hoped to achieve has all been discarded. It was discarded as soon as Trump took office because he was committed to reversing every one of Obama's policies. Yeah. He got added help by Havana syndrome, which gave him an excuse to empty out the U.S. embassy in Havana, even though there's no evidence that the Cubans had anything to do with it. There's actually no evidence that any foreign adversary at this point had anything to do with it, but be that as it may. So, you know, you're telling this story of great hope for a new era, and yet none of that happened. In fact, if anything, U.S.-Cuba relations are as bad as they have ever been in decades right now.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true now, and it's heartbreaking. I will say that it took a couple of years. In other words, the deal was in late 2014. Obama visits in 2016. The economy in Cuba gets better. The relationship develops. Americans go in large numbers to visit Cuba. There is some private enterprise that is underway in Cuba, which is, you know, for a socialist economy had been outlawed or banned for decades. There is a manifestation of hope in those first couple of years of the deal. Someone who you and I both know well, Peter Kornbluh, a Cuba expert, talks a lot about this on the show because he spent a bunch of time there in that interregnum, in that in-between period, that short period of peace, and just talks about Cuba starting to thrive and the relationship really turning. And then, you know, a bunch of things happen, and I'm going to simplify here because I think a big part of it is that, Donald Trump is elected, comes to office in part with this idea that he's going to undo all the things that Obama did or created or accomplished, you know, including the Iran nuclear deal, including the Cuba deal. And he sets about dismantling this deal. I will say, because I spent a fair bit of time on the eighth episode of this of the podcast talking about the Cuban side as well, there is some pushback by the Cubans, by the hardliners within the Castro regime to the deal, who see the deal as a kind of Trojan horse designed once again to undermine the Castros and the Castro regime, but this time in a different way. Instead of through coup attempts and assassination attempts, through this kind of charm offensive, which, you know, Obama, the most charismatic, you know, man in America in 2016, brings all that charisma, brings his family, his daughters, his wife to Cuba, and really kind of the Cuban people fall in love with it. All this creates a lot of tension for the Cuban hardliners. So there's a little bit of kind of allies on both sides, on the hard line of both sides in the United States and in Cuba, who want to see this thing undermined. But really, it's about Trump reversing the deal, at some point closing the American embassy in Cuba, bringing home diplomats, bringing home intelligence people who had been, you know, the CIA office in Havana, closing that down as well. Havana syndrome, so-called, is a big factor there. But by about 2017, 2018, there's almost nothing left of the agreement that they had negotiated.
So is this a story of what might have been?
I think it's partly that. I think it's a story of a diplomatic accomplishment that lasted long enough for us to take note and go back and retell and even celebrate. But also, yeah, a story of what, you know, administrations can do if they don't like. You know, this is what happens when the wheel turns and a new administration is bent on undoing the accomplishments of its predecessor. I will say, you know, what might have been, yes, but it is also a story of what could be, because if the two sides could do it once, if they could get together and negotiate an agreement and get past a long history of enmity, they can do it again. There just needs to be leadership on both sides willing to do it, and goodwill, and a reason to move ahead and do it.
Well, there's certainly none of that now on either side, I would say. And you were in Cuba, what, last year to make that final episode. I was in Cuba a year and a half before that for a series I did on Havana syndrome. And I was struck when I was there at just how much things had deteriorated. I mean, it was just a much more depressing place to be than when I'd been there, you know, 9 or 10 years earlier.
Yeah, I made two trips about 6 months apart. And even in that period, you know, so this was 2023, August 2023, and then February 2024, even in that period, things had deteriorated quite a lot economically, you know, and the great immigration out was underway. And these people who are leaving, you know, they are people who are able to leave, which means they are people who have some money or have some relatives abroad or have a profession. These are doctors and teachers and, you know, the professional classes who are, you know, leaving Cuba without those very important resources. I mean, it's very, very detrimental to Cuba. It's hard to watch. You know, I came late to reporting on Cuba in my career, but I think the thing that often happens to journalists happened to me as well, which is you become kind of spellbound by Cuba. It's this little country with a great story and great music and very friendly people, and so then it is just crushing to see how difficult things are right now.
Well, on that sobering note, which is a bit of a downer after what was a kind of somewhat thrilling, uplifting story of creative diplomacy, we should wrap this up. The series, it's 8-part. It's on Audible. It's called I Spy, U.S., Cuba, and the Secret Deal That Ended the Cold War. Dan, thanks for joining us. Great discussion.
Thanks very much, Mike.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.